What's up, everybody? Welcome back to the Next Deal Podcast. I am your host, Justin Dossi, of course, joined by wonderful Vince Hall.
Yo.
Today, we have an amazing guest, John Barbera. He's a good friend of mine. I've known him for a while now. He's a real estate investor out of Texas who has 11 years and over 400 deals under his belt, does some coaching, does all kinds of really cool stuff. So super excited to have him on this podcast today. John, how are you doing?
Doing very well. Thank you for having me.
Yeah. Thanks for coming on, man. I know we scheduled this forever ago, and time is finally here. So I'm excited for this one.
Well, you guys launched and it seemed like, you know, you sent me the calendar link and I looked at it. I was like, all right, I'll get to it. And then when I got to it, it was like March. I was like, Jesus.
You waited too long. All right,
let me book this now.
Yeah. It's crazy that it's already March too. Like it's still.
Oh, I know.
Yeah. My kids are almost done with third semester of school and they're going into the last quarter. I was like, how did that happen?
It's almost summer already.
Yeah.
I know. Yeah. I'm like, that means my son's going to be in eighth grade and then the next year he's going to be in high school and I'm going to throw up. Like this is weird.
Well, I'm in Texas, so we're already in summer.
Yeah.
Summer,
yeah. That's really fair. I had to wear a jacket to work this morning, so.
Oh, I had to wear shorts.
Yeah.
I actually got a heater under my desk right now.
Dude, I just turned mine off.
Yeah.
That's awesome.
My office always gets cold, and I was like, I'm kind of hot now. I'm going to turn the space heater off. Well, cool, man. Let's just kind of jump in. Tell us a little bit about you, how you got started. I know your story very well. You've got a very interesting background, but, you know, just tell us a little bit of how you got into this.
So I used to work construction, and the reason why I used to work construction is because I was born in Argentina, and we came over to the U.S. when I was about 7, and we were, you know, I was here for 20 years as an illegal immigrant, so we didn't come with any documents or anything. We came with a visitor's visa that was for 90 days, and we
stayed.
20 years later, we overstayed our welcome. So as an illegal immigrant, you don't really have options. You know, I was offered a scholarship to go to college for mechanics, for car auto mechanics, which is what I always loved to do. And when they found out I was illegal, they're like, oh, never mind. Like, you can't get this. So that's when I just gave up, dropped out of high school. And I just started working construction. My dad had a hardwood floor company. And my brother and I took over, and then we expanded it to remodeling and doing pretty much everything. And that was it. There wasn't really any options for me. And then I met a real estate investor, and I was like, what the hell do you do? He's like, well, I invest in real estate. I was like, well, I do the work. So what do you do? You know, and like, that's when it hit me. I was like, oh, there's another opportunity here, you know, and I didn't hang out with people like that. So my mindset wasn't entrepreneurship or anything like that. It was just, you work, you
know, there was
nothing else to it. Yeah. So I, learning that, I kind of started just self-educating, you know, and first book I ever read was, it's a book many of you haven't even heard of, but it's Rich Dad, Poor Dad.
I've never heard of it before.
Yeah, that's a new one.
You got to go to like these antique bookstores to find it. But but when I read that book, what it did for me was it showed me that it was possible to do what I wanted to do. Because my dad's motto was like, we were born to work and we're going to die working. Right? Like that was his motto. That's how what I grew up with. So when I read Rich Dad, Poor Dad, it's like, no, that's not true.
Mm-hmm.
And that's all I needed. Mm. So I just started chasing, you know, all the information. Back then, YouTube wasn't as big as it is now. And like, there wasn't as much like podcasts like this. There wasn't this type of free education. So I went to a RIA that was like about an hour away. I would go to it every month. And it was full of real estate agents and they all hated investors. So it was kind of ironic. But I started, you know, just kind of just stumbling my way through real estate and got started that way.
That's cool.
Yeah.
That's cool. Go ahead, Vinny.
So I was going to say, so 11 years ago, that was, I'm trying to do my math here.
Like 2013.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Gotcha. That's
cool. I'm like, what math are you doing?
Yeah. I'm trying to do the year that you came.
Throw the calculus in there. Yeah.
No, because it is crazy though when you talk about like YouTube and social media and the free education that we do have. It really wasn't that long ago that we didn't have that. It seems like it's been here forever, yeah. But it really hasn't. You know?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, dude, yeah. When I tell people that's like we didn't podcasts weren't as prevalent as they are right now. YouTube, like right now, everybody's a YouTuber. Every real estate investor is teaching how they're doing it, which I think it's excellent because you get to see so many different points of view of how to run this business. And one of the things I've learned is that I don't know two investors that run their business the same way. Mm-hmm. Like everybody's got their way of running it and it works for them. Right. Mm-hmm. And that's what YouTube has allowed is for everybody to, even though you'll hear these gurus like, this is the only way. It's not, it's their way, but it's still good to learn, right? It's still good to see what other options are out there. And yeah, when I got started, that wasn't a thing. Mm-hmm. So it was just more of you kind of got to get out there, try to work with people. And I started in New York doing real estate. And I remember I found a real estate investor and I was never entrepreneurial. Like to me, it was like, hey, how can I work for you? How can I help you grow your business? But everybody saw me as competition. They're like, oh, if I teach you, you're going to steal all my stuff. And it's like, well, I fucking stole your stuff anyway.
So yeah, you're like, go. Yeah.
You know, I'm like, smart guy. You could have had me working with you, but you know, now you made me your competition.
Right. Yeah.
But yeah, it was difficult at first because anybody that I would reach out to for help, like they just didn't want to help. Mm-hmm. You know, they're like, oh yeah, when you get something, let me know. I'm like, well, I don't know what something looks like. You know, like I just need some guidance.
Help me find that something.
Yeah. What was your first something? Was it a wholesale deal? Did you flip it? Did you life hack it? What'd you do?
So the first contract I got accepted, I was doing the strategy called, Dean Graziosi that came up with it, I guess. It's called 25-1. So you submit 25, 50% offers on MLS deals to get one contract. Okay, so we did that 25-1, and I got one accepted at $44,000in New York, and I freaked out. I was like, I don't know what to do now. Everybody always says, and that's the part that annoys me with a lot of these people. They're like, when you get the deals, the buyers are there. Bullshit. You know, like first of all, you don't know what a deal even looks like. You know, and who are the buyers that are supposedly magically going to appear, right? And so. Doing all that, it kind of taught me like, well, going back to that deal, I got it for 44 grand. I went on Craigslist. Again, this was a while ago. Went on Craigslist, put the property up there. I got a buyer that said he was interested. He stood me up. I freaked out and I just backed out of the contract. I was like, all right, never mind. Not even a month later, that house sold for 80 grand on the MLS. And I was like, that could have been a sweet deal. But it wasn't. And then the next deal I did, I made $100. And that was like 2 years later. It took me a while to get my first deal. And I got $100 because the guy I was partnering with screwed me over on it. But I was like, I didn't care. I was just in it to learn and figure out all these things. And yeah, I made $100 on a wholesale deal on that one. And it took a while to get going.
Yeah.
Like a lot of people, they're like, man, it's been 6 months. Like, it took me 3 years. Like, you're okay.
Yeah. And you had to do this without as much access to the amount of information we have now.
Oh, yeah. I mean, if I would have had half of the information I have now, I mean, it's so much easier to start. And even now, like, when people ask me, where do I start? I give them just two things to do. And within 3 months, they're closing their first deal. And they're like, oh my God, this is so cool. I was like, yeah, it's easy now.
Yeah.
You know, but shit was much harder.
Like I figured out the hard stuff for you. Here's the easy things.
just do this. It's much faster.
Yeah. So I know you moved from New York to Texas. Those 2 to 3 years while you were trying to get that first deal done, was that done in New York? Was that done in Texas?
In Texas.
Okay, got it. In Texas. So you pretty much have done all of your deals since then in actual Texas where you live now, which you're trying to move away from, but you'll be moving to Tennessee later this year. But started everything there. What was kind of like one thing we'll talk about later is like, and we could probably start it now, is people make things way more difficult than it needs to be. As a real estate investor, as a business owner, like the thing that I always tell people, especially if they're new or like in the coaching group that we met there, we didn't meet in that one, but where we've become really good friends in, is like business is simple, but it's not easy. You know what I mean? Like it's simple. There's a process, but it's not easy to do at the same time. So when you started, what was kind of your journey through that with figuring out just where to get started? Like you said, there wasn't a ton of education out there that was easily accessible, right? You had to go to classes or things like that. But I'm kind of curious what the beginning of this was like for you after that first $100 deal.
I mean, I went to every networking event possible because I don't know. I mean, looking at it now, you and I are both in Mike Kitko's Inner Wealth Group, right? And understanding how mine works, I realized like I had no faith in myself at that time. So I felt like I needed to know the right people. And if I just worked my ass off for these right people, that I would eventually get whatever trickles out of their pockets, right? Because of the value I bring them. So I was going to every networking event back then, the RIAs, they were funny because I would go to a RIA and it was like 8 of us, you know, that was mm-hmm. a RIA. Now you go to a RIA.
Not 300.
Like, oh yeah. It's a freaking event. Right. But it was 12 of us and there were like 2 RIAs in the whole city. Right. And so there weren't many options, but I was there all the time, just constantly meeting people, seeing people. What are you doing? Why are you doing this? What's that working? How's this working? And what do you need? And what do you need? How can I help you? Right. And it was just offering my time and my services. And because I'm from Argentina, I speak Spanish. I speak fluent Spanish. So in San Antonio, that's a great skill to have. Right. Mm-hmm. I knew construction. So it's like, hey, I can go analyze a property for you. Which funny enough, knowing construction is actually not a tremendous benefit. Because you tend to overanalyze every single deal.
I can see that. Know. This needs to be fixed. Yeah. This needs to be fixed. This needs to be fixed. Yeah.
And that's what it was. I went into every deal as a GC. And as a GC, I would look at it. I'm like, yeah, the molding needs to come out. The doors need to come out. The cabinets, all these things need to be replaced because they're old. Mm-hmm. And I wasn't getting any contracts accepted. And then when what hit me was partnerships. So I started working with other investors. And I was like, hey, I'll be your boots on the ground. I'll do whatever it is you need, right? I just need to learn the process. And these investors went with me to these properties. And I was like, yeah, but this house needs all this work. And he's like, no, we're going to paint the trim. We're going to paint the doors. We're going to resurface the cabinets and do new floors. And that's it. I was like, okay. And that was the first switch. It's like, I needed to be an investor, not a contractor.
It's the difference between a flip and a rent-ready property.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. No. And then even a wholesale deal and all that, right? Like everything's got the different numbers, but you got to look at it. And this is why I always tell people when they hire, they look for investor-friendly contractors. I was like, you know, it's the whole, to me, it's the shit that doesn't exist. Because what you're saying when you're asking for investor-friendly, you're asking for cheap, or somebody that knows what you don't know how to do. Mm. And both of those are dangerous. Mm-hmm. You are the investor. You need to tell the contractor what they need to do that's going to bring you the most value. Mm-hmm. And then the cheapest person is never going to be the best person. No. Because that's the person that's going to do part of the work, ask for more draws, and not show up to the job. And now you got to get rid of them and hire somebody else.
Yep.
Right? So I tell them, look for a contractor that knows how to do the job. What the job needs to be is up to you. You're the investor. You're the one that knows what's going to bring the most value. And if you don't know, you shouldn't be flipping a house, right? So learning that little thing was, it was tremendous. All of a sudden after that, I started evaluating properties different. I started kind of reflecting back on my other properties. And I was like, yeah, I was lowballing the shit out of everybody.
Yeah.
I did not realize. Because to me, it was like, the house needs everything. It's from the 70s. And as an investor, it's like, no, you don't need to do all that. You know, and just clean it up, paint here, do this, and it's ready to go.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. I think it totally, too, depends on, like, where that house is located, right? Like here in St. Louis, one house I might buy in Florissant versus St. Peter's, they're going to need to be flipped completely differently. Or like, say we're doing it for a rental, right? Rent Ready looks totally different on those two properties, right? Like you could get away very easily with keeping it grandma nice, right? In like the Florissant area, make sure everything works really well. Everything's well maintained. Appliances are good. Paint, maybe some floors, things like that. But like outside of that, like those are what the majority of rentals are in that area. Where you come out to St. Peter's, like if it's from the 70s, nobody's going to buy it unless unless they're going to be rehabbing it themselves, like we did in our house that we bought. And it's, you know, there's a totally different, I think that's an important thing too, is just based off of where you even are looking at and where you're working. Two deals could be completely different when they're 15 minutes apart. You know, it's not a huge difference in time of where those are located.
And even when you're running the numbers, one of the things that you said that a lot of people don't realize, Rent Ready doesn't always mean ARV, right? So you can get it rent ready and let's say it costs you 10 grand to get it rent ready, but that's not full ARV value, because to get a full ARV, that was probably going to be 30 grand mm-hmm. to get it to full ARV. Mm-hmm. But the problem here is that as a buy and hold investor, if you are running rent ready numbers with an ARV number, you're going to overpay for the house.
Mm-hmm.
Does this make sense? So like if you're not putting in 30 grand and you're calculating the ARV numbers, but you're only going to do 10 grand because that's all you need. Now, all of a sudden, you're negative 20 grand because you didn't factor that 20 grand to get the ARV value. So what I tell people is like, if you're going to do 10 grand to a house to acquire as a rental, then what is the house going to be worth with only 10 grand of work? Right? That's going to be a different value than the ARV value. Because the ARV, you needed to put 30. You didn't put 30. You put 10.
Mm-hmm.
So that house is worth less.
Yeah.
Yeah. And you're
does that make sense?
You're doing less rent too, or you're, you know, they're paying less rent for that too.
It could be. Sometimes you can get full market rent in that area, right? Because some areas are lower end, or it might be, you know, that they're just good with a house that's clean and move-in ready. But people that buy in that area expect a higher quality.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah,
but I'm saying like based upon like if someone was doing like the 1% rule, if they're doing it off of ARV, the rent would be more versus what they would do.
Right. Yeah. And what you're saying too is like I mean, it's basically the same thing you just said. But if you're buying a house for, let's say, long term for an equity play, right? Let's say the house is worth $100,000 ARV, fixed up, you know, to the nines, MLS ready, you know, but you buy it as a rental. And you put 10 grand into it, that house is that you might not have that extra 20 grand in equity. It might be worth really 80 with the work that you've done to it, is essentially what you're saying.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. So it's keeping track of those numbers, because I learned that the hard way, right? We bought a house, ARV was 150. So we're like, oh man, we're so in the money on this, because we only did, I think it was like 8 grand worth of work when we really needed to do 40. But that's all we needed to get it rent ready. And then when we got it appraised, it didn't appraise for the 150 because it wasn't 150 quality. Mm-hmm. We're like, oh shit. All right. Well, that's good to know, you know, because we thought we were going to get appraised at 150, right? Because that's what the values were. But the rehab that we did wasn't 150 rehab.
Right.
It was just rent ready.
It's not comparable to other houses in that range.
Correct. Yeah. So that's something that, you know, I don't really hear anybody talk about. And it's important when you're building your rental portfolio.
I was going to say, like, you had taught me this just even, I don't know, 2 months ago, maybe, of how you comp properties and how you make offers is totally different than the vast majority of people that I've talked to. So can you talk through a little bit of like how you do that and what you're, how you differ from most people of what you're looking for when you're comping a property?
Well, for wholesaling, everybody says you need to know the ARV and the repairs to be able to do 70% formula minus repairs, you know, and then minus your wholesale fee. And that's nonsense, because I've been doing this long enough to know that ARV is a matter of opinion. It's not a fact. You know, I've seen appraisals done that they make no damn sense, right? I've flipped hundreds of houses, and it's like the appraisals come back and I'm like, what the hell were you looking at?
Yeah.
You know, and it's an opinion. At the end of the day, it's an opinion. So you using your opinion to wholesale a house is actually harmful to you, because you could be off in the wrong direction and you're shooting yourself in the foot from making more money on that deal. And then we go into the repairs. The repairs are an opinion, because I used to do property tours here in San Antonio to kind of show people how we flip houses. And I would go over like, yeah, this house, we spent 55 grand. And they're like, oh, so I have a similar 1500 square foot home. So it's about 55 grand. I'm like, no. I spent 55 grand. I'm not saying you're going to spend that. If you don't hire my contractors, source the materials I source, manage the rehab the way I manage it, and take the amount of time I take on it, it may cost you more or less.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. You understand? Like this isn't a set formula that everybody likes to use. You know, there isn't one. And then the 70% formula doesn't make sense after 250 grand. After 250, because usually what it is with the 70% formula is you got your 30%, which covers profit and expenses. After 70%, the profit gets much bigger, right? So I've done houses that are 300 grand, where if I used that 70% formula, it was going to probably net me 40 grand in profit. But I was like, you know what? This is a quick in and out. I'm happy with 25, 30 grand in profit on this deal. Because it was like, I bought it in a week, cleaned it up, put it on the market, and it sold. I'm good with making a quick 25, 30 grand like that, right? But if I use the 70% formula, it throws all my numbers off. Now my offer needs to be much lower. Even if I'm buying from a wholesaler, you know, I can't be as competitive as other buyers are because I'm using the 70% formula. But when I run my numbers and I run my, you know, what's my actual closing costs? What are my agent fees? What are my holding costs? And then how much profit do I want to make? It's like, I'm probably buying it at 82%, but it's still making me 30 grand.
Mm-hmm.
So it's like, I don't care. Mm-hmm. What I measure at that point is what the risk is, you know, for how much money am I risking to what's the potential return on that investment. So that's the only thing I care about. And with wholesaling, it's the same thing. Like when I teach people about wholesaling, I tell them, I'm like, look, what is the house that you're looking at right now? What are other houses in the same exact condition selling for on the market right now? And then you look at that, come in underneath that number. What's the ARV? I don't care. Let the buyer figure that out. Mm-hmm. Because what I look at is if I put this house on the market, so let's say this house on the as is value is worth 120 right now. They're selling for 120 on the market. What I'm going to try to do is get it below that 120 and try to wholesale it at 110. Because if those buyers want to go buy that house, they're going to have to pay 120 because that's what those houses are selling for. Now I'm offering it to them for 110. So it's already a deal.
Yep.
But you say, what's the ARV? I don't care. The market has already spoken that 120 is what they're willing to pay for these types of houses. I don't care what the ARV is, because I've had buyers that they run their ARVs and they're so optimistic about it. And I have other buyers that are very, very conservative.
Mm-hmm.
Why am I going to try to guess at it?
Hmm.
You know, and that's how our wholesale fees have gone from, you know, 8-10 grand to $25,000-$35,000. Because when I put these properties on the market, I get buyers that they're like, yeah, I'll take it. When I run my numbers, I'm like, this house makes no damn sense. They ran their numbers and it made sense to them. Who am I to judge?
Hmm. Yeah. So you're looking at actual, instead of hypothetical data, you're looking at actual data is the big difference. Yes. Yeah. When you first told me this, I was like, I'm having trouble wrapping my brain around this, because I've heard for years, you know, 5 years at this point, of ARV, ARV, ARV.
70%, 70%, yeah.
Yep, 70% minus repairs or 75% minus repairs, you know. But then, like you said, repairs are subjective to every single person. The values are subjective within a margin, right? But if you're focusing on what properties in the condition you're getting it for selling in that area, then you're able to much more effectively have a truer number. And it's been cool for me, because I have some extra insight into your coaching stuff that you do, and seeing some of your students hitting those $20,000 to $30,000 wholesale fees just coming in right off the bat, when most people are, you know, struggling to get to 12 to 15, you know?
Well, and I think the unique perspective I have is that I am a buyer. So even though I started with wholesaling, I have also bought a ton of houses. I have a rental portfolio. Like, I've done it. So I know how to look at it, not just from a wholesaler, but from a buyer's perspective. And when a wholesaler comes to me and they say, hey, I have this house, they give me, here's the ARV, here are the repairs, here's, I'm like, dude, I don't care what your opinion is. Because your ARV is not my ARV. Your repairs are not my repairs. But it's only 20 grand in work. It's going to cost me 45. If you can do it for 20, go for it. Like, I've done this house many times. It's going to cost me 45. I know what my numbers are. You understand? Like, does it make that wholesaler right or wrong? No, it's just that deal is not a fit for me because I'm at 45. I got to run my numbers as an investor, right? So, and even when I wholesale properties or even tell my students, because they're used to like crafting this like very beautiful, you know, presentation of the property. It's like, look at this one pager of the house.
Yep. Yep.
They're like, how do you show your houses? I said, I text the address, a picture of the link, link of the pictures, and the asking price. That's all I send people. You run your numbers. What's the ARV? You figure it out. What are the repairs? You figure it out. I give you more than enough pictures for you to make a decision if you're going to be interested. If you're interested based on the pictures and the price and where the address is, then we can set up a time for you to go see the house. Mm-hmm. But at that point, you're just going to see the house to verify that the pictures were all correct, which they are, because I don't hide anything because it's just a waste of time.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So all the ugly shit you're going to see on the pictures. Right. And then when they go, yeah, they go, it's the same thing they saw in the picture. So it should be, you know, it's just to confirm. So it's a done deal at that point. So when people say, you know, I have a dispo department, like, why? Are you doing like more than 10 deals a month? No, I do 3. The hell you have a dispo department for? You're not even doing enough deals. You know, like, it's insane. You're just wasting money right now. And that's the premise too, is that I tell people, start spending very little and start making a lot of money. And when people get started in real estate, we start the opposite.
Mm-hmm.
We start spending a lot of money.
Yep.
We get everything under the sun to get started. I'm like, stop, just go get a deal done. You know, like, start making some money first.
Yep. Agreed.
Mm-hmm. And that goes back to the, you know, keeping things simple, you know, strategy as well. Like, you know, Justin and I, you know, we talk to people every single day about, you know, this kind of stuff. And man, some of the conversations I get into, people just overly complicating their tools and tech and their numbers and when they're going to start. And I mean, just like, I'm like, just freaking do it, man. Like, you can start with simply just doing Google Suite stuff. Get a Google Sheet that's really well done, a Google Form that's really well done. You know, get yourself Google Voice if you want to. It sucks, but it's a start. You know, like, you can do those things very, very simply. It's not going to cost you a ton of money right up front, and you can get a deal out of it. And then once you get that deal, then go get a piece of tool and tech that's going to help you a little bit more, right? Not everybody can afford ReSimply right away. As much as we love ReSimply, there's a lot of guys that can't do that. Or, you know, there's a lot of guys that, you know, can't afford the direct mail right away or a PPC ad. But they do have time and they can go out and, you know, knock some doors and do some driving for dollars or, you know, get on the MLS or whatever and make some offers. But yeah, like, the over complicating things is just insane. I mean, honestly, that's me in a lot of ways. Like, you know, I've been with Ballpoint and Call Porter for a couple of years now, and I've always talked about, I'm going to do this. But more fear and complicating things got in the way. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
Until it really just kind of clicked where I'm like, dude, this is so absolutely doable for me. And having, you know, the right partner and the right support and having your wife on board and all those things makes it less complicated.
Well, and then I think too, a big area is ego, right?
Yeah.
Ego plays a big factor in when you start this, because everybody wants to do it the cool way. Mm-hmm. And, you know, they want to have all the systems and all these things and everything. One thing that I try to tell people is first figure out if you even like this business.
Yeah.
Because it's not a like when you're starting off, it's not a sexy business. It's not what you see on Instagram. It's not what you see on social media. It's a lot of like the shit work, right? You got to be working with Excel sheets, managing leads, calling a bunch of people, getting cursed at, you know, going to properties that they stood you up on. You know, you get all these things that it's just not sexy. It's not glamorous, but you got to love it. If you love it, you'll figure it out. You know, and when you realize that you get the ego out of the way, the one thing I try to tell people, because it's like, it's the same thing, right? Well, I don't have the money for this. You don't, but there's somebody else that does. And they're probably looking for somebody that they can work with. So mm-hmm. How about you get creative and go work with somebody else? And it's like, well, I won't, you know, but then I got to split the profit. I'm like, understand what you just said. You got to split the profit.
Yeah. Like you have no profit right now.
You got nothing right now. You got 100% of nothing.
Uh-huh.
Like, what are we talking about here? You know, and I'm not saying make a partnership for the rest of your life. I'm just saying just to get you off the ground.
Yeah, learn some skill, man.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And those are things that I go back to, like keeping things simple is, and this is a talk that I gave this week in the mastermind, was leverage. When you can use leverage properly, and everybody thinks of leverage as far as like, you know, you're leveraging a down payment, houses, 1031, all these things in real estate. But there's also leverage of knowledge, leverage of time. There's so many other areas of leverage, right? Mm-hmm. And in this business, you can leverage somebody else's resources and connections and knowledge to your benefit to give you a massive shortcut when you're getting started. And right now, what I tell people, like investors that are flipping houses and buying rentals, many of them don't have the time to do acquisitions. That if you were to leverage their knowledge and resources, they'll pay for you to learn how to do acquisitions.
Mm-hmm.
You understand? They will pay for the CRM. They will pay for the marketing. They will pay for everything, because the one thing they can't pay for is the time.
Mm-hmm.
They need somebody that can put in the time. You understand? So yeah. If you're willing to come in and be like, hey, I'll put in the time, if you pay for all these things, go for it. But then the next thing is that, yeah, but I want 50%. I'm like, what? You're in it for the money, you know, mm-hmm. and it's not going to work that way. And don't get me wrong. You're going to make money. There's just no way you can't make money in this business, but you got to be in it to understand first. I always tell people the first year or so, it's just you understanding the business, you understanding the ins and outs of real estate, of structuring a deal, running through title, analyzing, dealing with a deal that breaks down, you know, dealing with sellers that try to back out or get another contract behind your back, you know, all these things you got to learn through and not prioritize the money, prioritize the knowledge. Because once you get the knowledge, you build the business, you know, so much faster afterwards. But when I see people that always sacrifice the knowledge for the profit, it's 3 years down the line and they're still struggling to make money,
mm-hmm.
because they never learned how to run a business.
Yep.
Because they were always the next deal, the next deal, the next deal. And I'm like, how about the next 100?
Mm-hmm. Well, dude, we had a guest last month, Devin Robinson, who talked about this a little bit, where one of his real estate ventures just kind of crumbled, and he was like, he was doing too many things and it wasn't working. So he spent 6 months of just learning. Like, he's like, I wasn't doing deals. I wasn't doing anything else. I was just learning everything I possibly could.
Mm-hmm.
Was it for sale by owners? Is that what it was?
Yeah, or
was
FSBOs. It?
Yeah. So he's like, I learned every single thing I could about FSBOs. And then the following 6 months, knocked out 70 deals.
Yeah.
Because he spent that 6 months building that foundation of literally everything you'd need to know about it, learning from everybody, seeing all the different stuff out there. And he was able to put that time and effort in. Then has that massive result there. And he's done that in every single thing that he does now, from raising money to having a doing nonprofit stuff to the, I forget what it's called, the installment method that they've been teaching, like all that kind of stuff. And it all comes from having that really strong foundation on it.
And that's why when people are starting off, the one thing I advise them against is virtual wholesaling. Because virtual wholesaling has the premise of go wide, not deep, because you can't go deep.
Yeah.
You know, you got to increase your chances of stumbling across a deal. And when you go that wide, you can only learn so much about a particular strategy, a particular list, a certain type of seller. But when you go deep and you learn everything there is to learn about that particular seller, like take foreclosures, for example, when you learn everything about the foreclosure process and what a seller in foreclosure goes through and how they're feeling and what options they have, it makes you so much better at handling foreclosure deals, where our primary source of revenue comes from foreclosures because we know how to work with these so, so well. We do strategies that other people are like, oh, I didn't know you can even do that.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like, well, yeah, because you can't learn it when you're doing foreclosures, probates, absentees, high equity, this market, that market, this other market, the other market in this other state. It's like, dude, you're spread way too freaking thin to be able to understand any one thing very well.
Mm-hmm. Not mastering and anything.
Yeah. And everybody, and I'm sure you can, verify this, Justin, but like every investor that I know that's a very successful investor, they did it doing one thing really, really well.
Yeah.
You know, mastered one thing.
Yeah. They mastered that one thing. I mean, dude, like Devin, we'll go back to him. 70 deals in 6 months from nothing. Like that's a crazy way to start. Like that's an insane amount of deals every single month. He's doing what, 12 deals a month? Like that's wild. Most people don't get to 12 deals a month in 5 years, and he did it in 6 months. And it's because he mastered that one thing. But I mean, yeah, like for stuff that we've done or that Ryan has done, we mastered direct mail. Right? That's what we're really good at. We're very good at direct mail. You and your teams are very good at cold calling, right? Like that's kind of something you focus on. And there's people that do PPC. They master that, right? That's the thing it's interesting in this business, specifically with real estate, is that like every method can work, right? There's not one that works and one that doesn't. Like every method works, but you have to understand how the method works first and be able to master that. Like we try and teach this all the time on sales calls with Ballpoint clients, I know, and Vinny's seen this on the call Porter side too, of people that, I'll give you a good example. I've got one guy right now that is talking to us. He's like, all right, he's like, I'm going to send 500 pieces of mail a month, and month one is going to be letters. Month two is going to be postcards. Month three is going to be postcards. And month four is letters. And month five is going to be this. And month six is going to be this. And he's only sending 500 each month. And our immediate thing was like, you needed to be doing way more than 500 a month, right? Like that's a very, very, very small sample size for direct mail. You have to do a higher volume. You have to be more consistent, but you're also, in his words, testing the waters to see which one works, right? Like you're testing the waters with such a small sample size, but then going from letter to postcard to letter and all these different variants. And it's like, well, I'll just be blunt. Like we understand the process and we've mastered how that process works and what cadence to follow and the quantity and who to target. But a lot of people do want to overcomplicate it, unfortunately. And then, you know, then we have calls month two. Well, why isn't this working? Well, let me tell you why. there's a couple things that we need to tweak and adjust, and then things start to work, right? So no matter what you're doing from a marketing standpoint, there's a way to make it work as long as you understand and master that one thing. Like I talked about this, I don't know, a couple weeks ago on Facebook, but it was like, you can't master 9 things at once. Figure out one, learn it, understand every single thing, start to scale it, then add something else in, right? Don't branch off into 9 different directions because it doesn't work immediately like you're hoping it will. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And what I find funny too is that, you know, I'm going to do direct mail. I don't know how to do direct mail because I've never done it before. I've never been successful at it, but here's how it's going to work.
Yeah. Like, yeah. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Got it.
You know, where does that come from? You know, and I tell people, I'm like, why don't you cheat? You know, like cheat. There are people that know what the hell they're doing. Ask them.
Yeah.
Especially if you're hiring the company that's going to be providing you the materials, I'm pretty sure you can ask them, like, how should I start? I'm sure they're going to help you. Because yeah. guess what? They want you to succeed because they're not going to make their money off this one order that you do.
No.
They're going to make their money off of keeping you as a long-term yeah. client.
So, right.
So, so they good. Have a very vested interest in you succeeding.
Yes, exactly. It's like I'm not telling you this just to sell you right now. Like if I wanted to do that, I would change what I'm saying. I would say, give me $10,000 now and then we'll do that. Right. But like, no, the whole point is I want you to succeed. We want you to succeed. And every other service-based business owner that I know has the exact same thought process. Like, we want you to succeed. We want you to make money and be successful because A, that benefits us long-term, but it also makes you much more happier and helps you be more successful long-term too.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. I do that all the time with call porter on consultations, discovery calls. Mm-hmm. Like if someone doesn't know what to do, I'll definitely give them the tools and the resources and how to do it. I always tell them, I'm not looking for a sale on the first call. It's never that anyways. Right. Very yeah. rarely does it ever happen that way, but I want to be able to equip people with tools and resources and strategies now so that, you know, 6 months down the road, they're going to be like, oh, I remember talking to Vince over there, really helped me out and got me started. I'm going to go back to him. And actually, you know, get this, that's who you're looking for. So I always, you know, try to give value literally to anyone that comes across my phone line. And I just listen to them, right? Like if you listen to them, you're going to figure out at the end of the phone call, what you need to resource them with. And that's more valuable to them when they leave the phone call. So, there's just so many different tricks and strategies and tools, but you know, listen for what that person really, really wants, give it to them and they'll be back.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I think what you need to do as an investor is figure out what's the goal? What is it that you want to achieve? And then go to somebody that achieved it and be like, how do I get there?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. What'd you do?
You know? Yeah. I have people that come to me and they hire me as a coach and then they're like, all right, John, here's what I want to do. And I'm like, I'm confused. Why'd you hire me?
Yeah.
And they're like, well, how do I do that? I was like, well, you don't. That shit's not going to work. Mm-hmm. But I want to do that. I'm like, okay, but it's not going to work.
Yeah.
You want to do what works or you want to do what you want to do? Like, what are we talking about here?
Yeah.
Like, what's the goal? Well, I want to close deals. And how about we do what closes deals?
Mm-hmm.
You know, just a thought.
Yeah.
You know, so...
Yeah, I'm talking to three guys that live in Detroit right now, and they all work W-2s. I think one's a physician. Actually, two of them are physicians. Can't remember the other one is. They actually love their jobs. They don't want to do anything else, right? But they love real estate as well. I think they did. I think he said they did like 44 deals last year, which is great for having, you know, W-2. Wow. It's three of them, and I was like, I want to know what you do. You know, like, how are you so successful at keeping your, you know, your jobs and, you know, doing this? Because they love what they do. But, you know, getting buy and holds and flipping some properties here and there, they love the extra income and, you know, having a vacation here and there that's paid for fully and things like that. But those are good people to know too, because you do get a lot of people that get into investing that, you know, they work a W-2 and it might not even be a W-2 they hate. They probably love it and, you know, they never want to leave it, but they also know that 20 years from now, they want to be set a little bit better, you know?
Well, I have one of my students, he's a full-time firefighter and he loves being a firefighter.
Yeah.
And we're right now, the beginning of March, but by the end of February, his goal this year was to make 200 grand. He's already at 150.
Wow.
And he's a firefighter with a small family, you know, and he does real estate when he has time. And when he told me that, I was like, it's crazy how it wasn't so hard, huh? He's like, it really wasn't. And he had been doing real estate before, you know what I mean? And it's like, it's just, we do complicate things because we feel that how can this be possible if it's not hard?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Right? So how can this make me so much money if it's not hard? And what I've realized is that it's still hard because doing the simple things are hard.
And you consistently know, doing the simple things.
Yeah. And I have another student, Jen and Rob in St. Louis, that Rob has an issue right now with too much freedom. And it's an issue. Like, it's an actual problem that entrepreneurs have. When we have too much freedom, we don't know what to do with it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, do we need to be working more? Do I need to be doing more? You become more stressed out. And it's like, that's a challenge. That's a problem still, you know? And as entrepreneurs, when you become an entrepreneur, everybody wants the free time. But when you have so much free time, it could be detrimental.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's like, the work still needs to get done at some point. So how, what are you going to do? How do you balance it? You either go all in on work or you do no work. Either way, it's going to affect you.
Yeah.
Right? So how do you have that balance? And what they realize is like, yeah, this is easy to make money, but what do I do with the rest of my life? And I'm like, yeah, it's a real issue to be in. Because it turns out that it affects how you're making money. Because then if he gets into a funk, he doesn't make calls. He doesn't get appointments. He doesn't get deals. You know, and you get a good month. And you know, the one thing I've realized about good months is you get a good month because of the work you did the last 4 or 5 months.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's why you had a good month today.
Yeah.
So if you relax now because you had a good month in May, June, you're going to have a really shitty month.
Mm-hmm.
Or if you have a good month and you're like, oh, I'm going to stop marketing.
Yeah.
Exactly.
I'm gonna stop doing it. Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah. I'm gonna take a break.
Right.
And it's like you're not there. And that's why the thing that I focused on, and this is what happened to me. I started with wholesaling. I hated wholesaling. We got into flips and rentals as soon as we could. So we completely let go of wholesaling. And 2020 happened and our deal flow went to nothing. Because we were getting deals from wholesalers and agents and our network. And when 2020 happened, like people were able to wholesale deals for like 40 grand more than what we were willing to pay.
Hmm.
So nobody was bringing us any deals. I don't blame them, but it sucked for us.
Yeah.
Right. So what we had to go back into creating our acquisition business. And when we went back into it, man, I got depressed again. I was like, I hate this. Like, I hate wholesaling. I hate having to do this. But what I realized is that I was never looking at it as a business. I was looking at it as this is just a way to flip houses. This is just a way to acquire rentals. And when you look at it that way, you don't think through systems and process of where can you put efficiencies in to make it less stressful for yourself. And it took me a while. It took me up until the end of 2021 to realize that. And I had 2021 was like one of my worst years because it was like just straight burnouts the whole year. Like I was burning out like almost every single month. I was getting so fried. I hated real estate. I hated my life. Like it was just beyond stressful. And when I started realizing that it's like, oh, I'm not looking at this as a business. And I started looking at it as a business. I started realizing, all right, where are the repetitive strategies? Well, these are repetitive. Cool. Let me take this piece out. Let me get a VA, plug them in. That's outsourced. Done. And it's working very well. Awesome. All right, cool. Now I got more time. All right, now this is becoming fun. You know, I'm no longer in Excel all day long trying to manage leads and filter and clean up lists and stack them and figure shit out. And it was a nightmare.
Yeah.
And I got all that taken care of. And then that's when I started thinking through what are my repeatable processes, right? And when I took that step back and I started looking at it, I was like, well, it all starts with these three things always, right? So when I started looking at those three things, we put systems in place for those. We put systems in place for how we sell, how we contract, how we dispo, how we hire, you know, put all these systems in place. And then it's like, right now, we're in 2024. All of last year, I don't think I ever walked a house. And we're still buying houses. And I haven't seen a house in over a year.
Not a bad problem to have.
Yeah, I haven't spoken to a seller in I don't know how long. You know, because it's like, I don't need to anymore. I don't need to just because I already spoken to tens of thousands of sellers. That's like, I know what they're going to say.
Yeah.
But I've been able to train a team and I've been able to build a team in a way that I hope my team doesn't take offense to this. But if they stop performing, I could take someone out, plug someone in and keep everything going.
Yeah. I don't think there's offense to that. I think it's a testament to the system you've built.
You know exactly.
I mean? Like, and it's similar here, you know, at Ballpoint and Cole Porter, you know, there's systems and stuff in place for multiple departments where if somebody did decide to leave, then, you know, we can bring somebody in and put them in there. I mean, it would suck. Like, I love our team, you know,
right.
But there, you have to build your system to be able to account for that kind of stuff. Right. And it's, I had someone tell me a while ago, and I'll be honest, not every department's perfect, right? Like there's stuff that I don't know or stuff that we haven't ironed out yet or fully systematized in certain aspects of our business. But I had somebody tell me a while ago that said, if you lose somebody and you have to hire somebody new, or if you hire somebody for a new role and you get busier, your systems and processes aren't set up properly. Like,
yeah.
Yeah, that's a good way to look at it. Like, cause I've had times where, I mean, shoot, last year we lost an entire sales team at Ballpoint and Cole Porter, moved some stuff around. We had Vinny kind of move back into sales stuff. We hired my dad on over here at Ballpoint, and it was like immediately I was like, oh man, I have so much shit to do and so many calls and so much training and all this kind of stuff to do. And it's like, we'd probably still have that problem, right? Like if we lost salespeople, like we'd still have to figure some stuff out on there. But ultimately, like it's better than it was a year ago because more stuff is documented. There's more systems into that process now and makes it a little bit easier to manage and grow.
Well, and that's the issue when scaling this business, especially in acquisitions, wholesaling, is people say, you know, you just can't find good people out there. You can't find good closers. You can't find this. And I'm like, because you're usually what the issue is that you're trying to find one person that can replace you. And as the business owner, I think that's an impossible task.
Mm-hmm.
You can find a person that can replace a portion of what you do. Then you can find another person that can replace another portion of what you do. Right. Because as business owners, we wear all the hats, you know, so it's like you're trying to find another you, you know, this is going to be pretty. I'm not saying it's impossible. Anything's possible, but you're looking for a C-level suite exec that, you know, is going to come in wanting multiple six figures a year to replace you because they know how to run a business, you know? So it's like, let's start with the tasks that are, you know, the more tedious and don't really bring in the actual revenue, and somebody can, you can outsource it. Somebody else can do. So I start with VAs, and my VAs, I give them, hey, this is what you do. Well, I also have this other task. Okay. I'll hire another VA. This is what you do. You know? So then they're like, just plug and play, you know? So everybody's got their process. One falls, I pull that piece out, put a new piece in, and it keeps going. I don't miss a beat. Before, when I would lose an acquisition person, we could be down for months, you know, because it was me having to step back in, having to figure this out, start the hiring process again, start the interview process, start the training, do all this. It was ridiculous.
Yeah.
Now it's like, I can get, especially for acquisition, I can get somebody rocking and rolling within a week, you know, and because our systems and our processes are so good, that's like, I don't even need you to be that good. I just need you to follow the system and we're going to get deals.
What does, since we're kind of on that topic, what does your team look like currently? I know like you've set it up to where you're not having to see properties or walk them or anything like that, but curious kind of what your team is set up or how that looks right now as far as team members.
So I have one acquisition person. He's the one that builds a rapport with the sellers and goes to see the houses. I have two VAs that they sort through the mess of like all the leads, manage them in the CRM and all that. And then it's, my business partner, John Barr, he does the project management and he does the coordinating, like the closing coordinating. So when they get, we do a lot of messy deals. And what that means is because we do probates and foreclosures, we deal with a lot of airship issues. We deal with, you know, like there's documents missing. There's a whole mess going on. So John specializes in that area of all that. And at this point, I just specialize in like just training and making sure that the systems are all working, right? So if there's something that's not being efficient anymore, we start looking at a new process. We started looking at a new system. And I'm always looking at new systems anyway, because I've been in it long enough to know that nothing lasts. Mm-hmm. You know, you get people, even right now we use ReSimply, right? And I love using ReSimply. I'm sure at some point they're going to fuck it up, right? Because they're already trying to, they keep adding more shit to it. And I'm like, you're going from a CRM to wanting to have websites, to want to do list tagging at some point. And every time you introduce something new, the other shit breaks. I'm like, at some point you're going to just fuck it all up and the CRM is going to suck. Mm. You know, it's just kind of what I've seen. I hope it doesn't, because I love using the system, but it's just kind of been what's always happened with every system I've owned in the past. Mm. It's like, it starts off great. And then they get, you know, how do we grow? How do we scale? And then they break it, you know? Mm. And so we're looking at other ones, and we test other ones. We test out REI Sift, you know, we're looking at other services. We're looking at other CRMs. Like, I'm always on the hunt, seeing like what, because what I don't want to happen is, let's say something happens to ReSimply, I'm out of, you know, yeah, I'm out of luck.
You don't want your whole business to fall apart if that happens.
Exactly. I want to be able, if that happens within a week, I'm on order to a new system and we didn't miss a beat.
Yeah.
You know, so it's like I said, it's not that I'm hoping things go wrong. It's just that as a business owner, it's my responsibility to make sure that I'm watching for, you know, like the SWOT analysis, right? What are our weaknesses? What are our areas of opportunities? So I'm always looking at like, what's the next area that we can maybe take advantage of? And sometimes by doing that, you see systems that's like, you know, this can make things easier. I didn't realize this existed, right? So where people, they find something that works and they just put their head in the ground and they just, you know, iron that shit. They work on that shit until it's dead. Mm-hmm. And then when it dies, they're like, what do I do now? It's like, well, you should have asked that question when it was working.
Yeah.
You know, so then this doesn't happen.
Well, and you can run into like regulation issues, like we saw with, was it Go High Level that had all the issues a couple months ago, that I don't remember if it was them or it was one of the major texting platforms, though, that like overnight people didn't have a business anymore because everything was focused on texting through that one platform. Yeah. And I don't remember if it was Go High Level or if it was something else.
No, so, it wasn't Launch Control. It was Lead Control. Sherpa.
Lead Sherpa. Yeah, Lead Sherpa was one. Was Launch Control one too, Vinny?
Yeah, I was going to say probably Launch Control. Or yeah.
No, Go High Level is a CRM. I'm mixing things
Yeah,
up.
Go High Level.
Yeah.
If you're from Go High Level, sorry if you're listening. My bad.
But even when like Lead Sherpa went down and Launch Control started acting up, like people, I saw people like reaching out to me and they were like, what do I do? What do I do? I'm like, well, I stopped using those platforms like 8 months ago. Because this was going to happen. We already saw it. Mm-hmm. When they started modifying a lot of their messages, a lot of the campaigns, a lot of that, I'm like, the writing's on the wall. Mm-hmm. Like, regulation's coming in hard for text blasting.
Yeah.
They're going to make it where it just doesn't work anymore. And that's where we're going. I was like, why wait for that to happen? Yeah. Let's tackle that now. So yeah, we made that adjustment like long before they started having those issues.
Interesting. Yeah, I think that's something that any business owner needs to focus on, is where can things fail and where can we be ready for it. I mean, we're doing that now in Ballpoint with one of the softwares we use internally. That's it's what we use to track everything for production orders. And it's like, it's clunky. There's times it doesn't work the way it's supposed to. And it's almost like we're forcing a system to do what we want it to do instead of being within that system the way it's meant to operate. So we literally hired somebody to build a massive, complex Google spreadsheet to do exactly what we need it to. And the operation is 10 times simpler than what we use now. And instead of like $2,500 a month, it's free, basically, after the development costs and maintenance costs on it. And it'll work 100 times better because it's literally, we'll do every single thing we need. Nothing extra of all this other BS that's out there that we don't even worry about right now, and be able to make the entire like production floor just seamless and make it a lot easier.
Nice.
But then it's also, I think with that, it's the letting go of the ego, where, you know, we know somebody that I suggested the CRM that we use, mm-hmm. and they're like, no, I'm using this one. And
I'm like, yeah.
Okay. All right.
I spent a couple $1,000s to build this. Well, it might cost you a lot more than that, though. Long term.
And it's that fear of like, but I just did all this work. Yes. And that's going to happen a lot when you run a business. I've built a lot of things that I've spent months building to only scrap it as soon as I was done.
Oh, dude. Vinny knows this because he's been around for this, but we've tried to switch the call center software 3 times now at Call Porter, and it never works the way that we need it to. And then we just go back to the same system. I'm like, all right, I'm done fiddling with the system that we have. It works. There's no issues with it. Service levels are good. It does what we need it to do. Like, I'm done fucking with that system.
Mm-hmm. And it goes back to let's bring it back to wholesaling, right? Like, when somebody's working on a list that's produced them deals in the past, and then it stops producing deals, and they keep working on the same list. Mm-hmm. They keep working on the same list, and they keep working on, I'm like, dude, move on. Like, but you don't understand. I did, you know, 20 deals off of this 2 years ago. It's like, yeah, it's been 2 fucking years. Move on.
Yeah.
It doesn't work anymore. You know? So like the same with foreclosures here in San Antonio, we stopped doing foreclosures in like 2018, and people are like, you know, oh, that doesn't make sense. Blah, blah, blah. I was like, it made sense to us, because we looked at the data. And the properties that were getting foreclosed on at that time were the bottom of the barrel. So they had a reinstatement of like 90 grand. It was ridiculous.
Ugh.
And yeah, so I was like, they're just getting crap out right now. And most of these properties are underwater. I don't care. 2021, we started with foreclosures again. Right after the forbearance period was starting to be up, we started with foreclosures again. And people are like, you know, they were, oh, it doesn't make sense because of this or this or that. I'm like, well, you're being emotional about it. I'm looking at the data. And just 2 weeks ago, I had somebody message me, send me like a snippet of like, yo, did you know foreclosures were coming back? I was like, dude, I've been closing deals in foreclosures for the last 2 years.
You're like, I do. I do, actually.
Yeah, where have you been?
Where have you been?
But it's been because, and the people that don't want to do foreclosure now, they waited too long to stop in 2019, 2020. And when they finally stopped, they stopped out of anger. So now they're just angry at foreclosures.
Bitter at it. Yeah.
Yeah. And I'm like, why are you being emotional? Like, don't be emotional towards this. They're just flows in the market.
So
you know?
Important.
So yeah. So
important.
To me, it's like, I don't keep any, you know, resentment or anything. It's like, we were killing it before. In 2021, we were calling it marketing to senior citizens, people that had the 65 and over exemption, that owned the house 15 plus years. Chances are they were dated houses, right? They were too big for them. They wanted to downsize. So we were doing really well. We were getting some good deals out of that. 2022 started, taxes went through the roof. Interest rates were already high. All these things happen. So these senior citizens, all of a sudden, I was having calls with them, and they're like, well, where am I going to go? I'm like, well, shit, yeah, that's a great question. You know, like,
yeah
if you sold this house, you get 50 grand in your pocket, you can't even afford this house again.
Mm-hmm.
Because the mortgage payment, everything's too high. So all of a sudden, I saw it's like the motivation went away.
Yeah.
The want to sell went away. So we're like, all right, we got to shift our marketing. I didn't get emotional about it just because we were crushing it the year before. It's like, all right, and it's over. And right now we're doing foreclosures until we stop. And then that's over. And we'll go to the next thing.
Yeah.
Until it doesn't work. And then we go to the next thing.
Yeah. And that's, like, dude, that's an important thing to note too. Like, as a business owner, and Vinny, this will help too with stuff you're doing with Matt Camp with the real estate side of things, is like, as a business owner, you can't make decisions from an emotional place. No matter what, yeah. as much as you want to, because there's times where you're like, no, I'm fucking pissed. This person did this. They're gone. Like, you know what I mean? Like, I've had those moments, and it's like, okay, let's think about this rationally. I was on a call with someone the other day who I've worked with a long time as a mentor, like kind of on and off over the years. And he said that like,
he won't even make decisions in his business if he's had too much caffeine, because he thinks differently and behaves differently when he's amped up on coffee versus when he's like at a calm, neutral state to be able to make decisions. And I'm like, you're much more in tune with your shit than I am, to be able to recognize that. But, you know, not making, I mean, whether if it's a marketing decision and a personnel decision, a business direction decision, a disposition decision or whatever, if you're making it from emotion, that's where things go wrong very, 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 yeah, very quickly.
Yeah. I mean, I started doing breath work, and now before I start anything, I go through my breath work exercise.
Did you do the one I sent you?
No. I hired somebody local we did like one-on-one class sessions and everything. And she taught me a few techniques, and it's like, I do that before I do anything, you know, before we hopped on this call, before I do a training, before anything, I do my breath work. And then all of a sudden it's like, I'm coming at it from a much more clear point of view. Cause I used to be ran by my emotions. Like, I mean, I was angry. I will make angry decisions. I will, you know, snap judgments, just, fuck everything. Let's just go, you know? And now it's like, no, I center myself first. And then you realize it's like, it's really not a big deal. No, it's not that important. Or we can just do this. So
for people who don't know what the hell we're talking about with breath work, what step by step, what do you do?
So breath work, and the practice I did, is they call it somatic breath work. It just, the way I look at it is like, you can do meditation, right? And I look at it as like a form of meditation. But meditation, okay, you got to be able to like kind of like get into it and quiet the mind, or be able to focus on it. And sometimes for some, like somebody like me, that I tend to lean more towards anxiety, ADD, and like can't sit still, that's hard. But breath work forces you to relax, because you're moving your body in such an intense way that's like, you cannot not be relaxed afterwards. It doesn't work that way. So you pretty much, like, I do 5 deep breaths through my nose. Like, I always say, like, if you had a plate in front of you of cocaine and you're trying to snort it from here, you know, it's like, you're just, it's like an excessive.
From thing, here. Right? I love that.
Yeah. That see if you can make it. And I have a big nose. So, you know, see if you can, get something.
I don't know. I think I can compete with you with this schnoz. No.
So you just like an excessive like breathe in, and you all the way and fill it, but lift your gut, not your chest, because like, we tend to breathe from our chest, but it's from your stomach. You fill your stomach up, and then you blow out, like if you had a candle that was 3 feet in front of you and you're trying to blow out that candle, you know, and you do that 5 times, and you're going to feel lightheaded when you're done, but you're also going to feel like, this feels good. You know, like all of a sudden it's like your worry went away. The anxiety went away. Everything went away. And that's what it was for me. It's like, I needed something that pulled me out of my head, like forcefully.
Yeah.
Because I mean, I'm stubborn, you know, when I
get
in
Disney real quick, will pull you out of your head real quick. Like, why do I feel like this?
Yeah, exactly. So, and doing the breath work, that's exactly what it does. It gets you, because you have to focus on the breath. You have to focus on what you're doing, so you actually do it. And then it just, by the time you're done, you added so much oxygen into your body, into your brain, into everything. That's like, you have energy, you're more focused, you're more centered. I mean, it's not even a thing of like, oh, I don't believe in that. Well, it's not a question.
It's science. Yeah, it's science. It's very, very well known that like, anxiety has a very hard time thriving in an oxygen enriched environment. Like my sister's a nurse, right? And she's told me, like, if people are in the ER and they're just like freaking the hell out, right? Like they're having a massive panic attack, they can give them something to do. But the number one thing they tell them to do is deep breaths, slow, drawn out deep breaths. And it helps fix that. And you and I have talked about it, but I've had anxiety issues for years. And like, I do it every morning. Like I do 30 of them. I do them in 3, three sets of 10. Yeah, three sets of 10. I was trying to think. I was like, am I doing 30 or 40? I couldn't remember. But do three sets of 10. And like, I'd start my day off that way. And there will be times where like I might wake up feeling a little anxious for whatever reason. I feel great after that. Feel a little lightheaded for a few minutes and then it goes away. But it's, you're just adding more oxygen to your blood and your body's just getting adjusted to it. But I have noticed it gets, the more I do it, the less dizzy I am also.
Yeah.
Because my body's used to it.
And that's what it was. What was difficult for me when I first started. It's like, all right, you're going to do breath work. Like, the fuck does that mean? I already know how to breathe. Like, if I didn't know how to breathe, I would not be here.
Yeah.
Like, I think I got that taken care
of. It does it on its own.
Yeah. You know, it's kind of survival.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, there's and when you mentioned that, it just reminds me there's Tony Robbins has an exercise called priming. And he does exactly that. It's 30 breaths, three times, and they're strong. They're like, you know, in, out, mm-hmm. you know, for 30 times. But then he follows that with gratitude, visualization, and all that. It's about 15 minutes. I think he calls it like 15 minutes to thrive or something like that. But I do that every now and then too. That it's just, it's all now it's becoming science. Where they talk about, they can, Dr. Joe Dispenza, he talks about how, like, when you start practicing gratitude, how it opens the valves in your heart. Like, it actually allows your heart to pump better, you know, and more efficiently when you practice gratitude, because it changes your body,
mm-hmm.
right? So it's like, don't practice gratitude to be like, oh, I'm just grateful, because that doesn't do anything. But if you feel it, like,
just grateful.
Yeah, I'm just grateful, you know? Life is awesome.
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, now that the science is coming around, and I am a lot more like left brain. So same. To me, before the woo shit was like, yeah, I don't get it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I'm just going to think this way and things are magically going to happen. You know, I'm like, yeah.
Seeing the science behind it for me, I'm like, okay, this clicks a little bit more. Like if I see science behind something, I'm like, all right. Because I'm the exact same way. I'm such an analytical, left-brained, stubborn person that I'm like, I don't know about that until I learn about it a little bit more.
Well, that's why we tend to have more of a, I think, an addictive personality, where it's like we could be addicted to medications, drugs, alcohol, because it's something that you do and you feel better, even for the moment.
Yeah.
So there's evidence there. Where with this other stuff, it's kind of like you do, but you got to believe in it for it to start changing. And sometimes that works with stacking over the course of weeks. And so it's a lot more of on faith than it is like when you take a pill or you smoke weed or you drink something. It's like that's, you know, immediate.
Mm-hmm.
You start feeling or you start numbing whatever the issue is right away.
Yeah.
Yeah. Burying it. Yeah. I'm big on like the meditation. I know I like if I have a day that I don't do it, I know, you know, I love going on walks. That's a big thing for me is if I get stressed out or, you know, frustrated or even just kind of like restless, you know, like if I feel like at 2 p.m. I'm like, oh, a cup of coffee could really solve this. Well, no, but 15-minute walk actually does a lot better than a cup of coffee at 2 p.m.
Mm-hmm. Then at 5 o'clock, you're not like, huh.
Yeah, right. And just getting out there and like getting the fresh air. And if it's a sunny day, like when we talk about the science behind vitamin D for our bodies is insane. Like, you know, in the winter months here in St. Louis, just get some vitamin D, man, pills when you're not getting it in, you know, as you are in spring, summer, and early fall and such, it does a world of difference.
I immediately feel better when the sun comes out. I'm like, yes,
immediately
outside. Yeah.
Immediately.
Yeah.
And meditation just helps to, you know, just reorganize your body and your thoughts and, you know, kind of gain some perspective and balance. And it's super helpful.
And what's funny with all this is that why it's so important is mindset is everything. And I believe mindset is more important than strategy and all this, because I have one-on-one coaching calls with some students, and I kid you not, probably 80% of those calls are mindset. It's not even strategy, because mm-hmm. it's like, I can give you, I like kind of like what you said, Justin, earlier when I told you about how you, as a wholesaler, you don't need to run ARV. Mm-hmm. And you're like, I struggle to wrap my head around
it. Yeah.
The strategy is simple, but if you can't wrap your head around it, you're never going to execute on it. It's never going to work. You're never going to make it work, right? So it's not that the strategy is complex. The stuff that, so part of my course is 9 pillars that I teach, right? They're very simple. They're not hard. But if you can't understand why they're there, or if you don't accept it because you feel like it needs to be harder, you will never execute on it. And I have students that they're doing the same exact thing. They're killing it every single month. And I have other students that are like, I don't get it. Mm-hmm. It's all in your mind. You're making this harder than it needs to be, you know, and it's funny. But when you look at their habits, their routines, their everything, it's like, yeah, you don't value mindset. Mm-hmm. You do nothing for your brain. You just get up and you start working because that's what's important to you, you know, and it's like your mindset's what's keeping you broke, you know, yep. And that's why, like, meditation, breath work, going outside, you know, staying active. It's not an opinion. Mm-hmm. There's no coincidence why the biggest entrepreneurs and business owners have a practice that they follow. Mm-hmm. And it works very well for them.
Yep. Couldn't agree more. And if you don't have one, get one.
Oh, yeah. And you got to try, right? Like, I know for me at first, it was frustrating whenever I hear somebody talk about, here's my morning routine. I'm like, yeah, you jackass. You have millions of dollars. You can afford to, you know, go into your cold plunge, infrared sauna, get a massage, have this thing. Like,
go to the gym.
Yeah, good for you, buddy. You know, yeah. Like when you have a family and you run a business and you don't have all that excess capital, it's like, I can't wake up every day and have this magical morning. You know, I wake up and sometimes the kids woke up earlier and it's like, well, there goes my morning. You know, I got to mm-hmm. take care of the kids. Right. So it's like, it makes it hard because then you feel like, well, I can't do that morning routine. Therefore, I don't do any morning routine.
Yeah.
And it's like, no.
You have to find what works for you.
Try to do anything. That's why I like breath work, because it could be done with as little as like 2 to 5 minutes. You know, the 30 breaths that you're talking about, I doubt that takes you more than 5 minutes to do.
Less than five. Yeah.
Yeah. So, and it already puts your body in place. You know, it puts your mind in place. Like, eat healthy, hydrate. There's so many simple things that you can do, regardless of how busy your life is, to keep you in a much healthier state of mind and body.
Yeah. Couldn't agree more. It's funny. I, going back to like the, you know, seeing the people that'll post about their morning routine online. I saw one from, I think it's Chris Cron the other day. He was talking about his morning routine is 5 hours long. I was like, you're insane. Like, no, nobody, like, I got 3 kids. I can't do that.
Yeah. I'm like, have you ever, an hour. Listen to Mark Wahlberg's routine. Holy crap.
Any of the one, doesn't he get up at like 3 a.m. every day and is like in the gym for 2 hours first thing? Like,
then he comes back and does kid routine. Then he goes back to the gym. Yeah. And then
that's he's wild.
In bed by like 8:30, 9 o'clock every night.
Yeah. You have to be.
Yeah. I think when you follow like somebody's morning routine, try to follow somebody that has more or less a similar lifestyle to the one that you want to have, mm-hmm. right? Like not a movie actor or a single entrepreneur or somebody that doesn't have any kids or, you know, like try to follow somebody that you can kind of relate with. That's not, that doesn't have this, you know, 5 hour morning routine. That's like,
yep.
Yeah, that seems so ideal, buddy. Yep. You know? And that's kind of what I started doing. It's just, I have my non-negotiables that I do. And if I have an early day the next day, I just set my alarm for an extra 30 minutes before. And I can knock it out in 30 minutes, mm-hmm. you know? And it may not be the full thing, but it's enough. And if I can get my full routine done, you know, 3 times a week, that's awesome. Yeah. And that's just what it is.
Yeah. Business people with you know, that are single and no kids. I'm like, we're not even on the same planet.
Like, I don't know why I'm on your feet. I'm the wrong avatar.
Right. We're not even, we don't even know. We can't even talk to each other. I'm sorry.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Dude, I had one final thing here I'll throw in, and then we can kind of start wrapping up here. But I had my first coach ever tell me, cause I was like, I can't be a morning person. I was like, I can't get up at 5 a.m. It's just not me. I'm not that person. And he was like, okay, cool. He's like, so what does a morning routine look like for you? I was like, I don't know. I can't get up at 5. And he's like, okay, cool. What's a morning routine look like for you? I was like, I don't know. I can't get up at 5. And he kept saying the same thing over and over. And I was like, yeah. What are you trying to say? He's like, what I'm trying to say is like, do whatever the hell works for you. He's like, he has 6 kids. 2 sets of twins. So 4 of his kids are two twins, 2 sets of twins, right? He's 2 more. He has 6 kids. And he's like, I wake up at 7:30 every morning. He's like, my kids get up at 7:30. I get them ready for school. I get them off the bus. I get them off to the bus. I make breakfast with them and do all that kind of stuff. He's like, I'll have maybe 30 minutes where I can exercise or do something. And he's like, and I read 150 books a year. And I was like, how are you doing this? He's like, I just do it at night. He's like, it's what works for me. He's like, you don't have to be like every single person that's out there. Do what works for you in your routine. And he's like, my wife and I, we hang out for a while after the kids go to bed. Then she goes to bed and I've got 2 solid hours where I can just dive into whatever the hell I want to do. He's like, I go to bed at 11. I'm up at 7:30. It's 7.5 hours. It's plenty for me. He's like, and I get all my stuff done mentally that I want to do. At night, physically, I do something in the morning. He's like, you don't have to be up at 5 a.m. if it's not for you. Like, mm-hmm. Interesting. Yeah. So I had to find what worked for me.
But that's, I think, the issue is that we should ourselves so much of like, but I should have a morning routine. It's like, okay, but you can't. So let's move on from that and let's still get it done today. Like, what are the good things? Like, work on your mindset. You know, take some quiet time. Quiet time. Whatever that means. Is it meditation? Is it going out for a walk? Is it breath work? I don't care. Just be with yourself. Be with your thoughts. Mm-hmm. Because we don't shut ourselves off long enough to kind of think through our situations. And that's where the stress comes in. It's like your brain needs time to process. Like, mm-hmm. Go for a walk with no music. Just go out for a walk. Let your mind think whatever it wants to think. Do whatever it wants to do. Those exercises and then read. I don't know if it needs to be 150 books a year, but
oh no, he's a machine. And he implements what he reads too. That's the differentiator. That's impressive. Yeah, it's wild.
Impressive. But yeah, read anything that, you know, it's going to feed your mind. It's going to grow you. And it's like, do those whenever you fit them in. That's it.
Mm-hmm.
Fit them in at lunch. Fit them in when I get a lot of reading done when I take a shit. Right. So it's like nobody bothers me while I'm on the toilet. It's one of those things that's like work it wherever you can.
Yeah.
You know, so it's just, I think it's, I have a friend that he does this annoying thing that's called like a task audit.
I'm that friend.
But when you start auditing the things that you do throughout the day, you realize that you actually have more time than you think you do.
Mm-hmm.
But it's easy to generalize and say, I just don't have the time.
Mm-hmm.
And then you just shut everything off.
Yep.
And it's like, let's start tracking that time.
Yeah.
What do you do every single day? You know, it's like, well, I need to unplug too, you know, but being numbing yourself in Facebook or Netflix and on Facebook and on this, that's not unplugging.
Mm-hmm.
You keep your mind constantly stimulated. You understand? So it's like, what's priority? If nothing changes, what's priority?
Mm-hmm.
Right? So I think when you start taking control of those things, you realize how much time you actually have and how much better life gets.
Yeah. Agreed. Love it. It's a good way to end this.
Yes, sir.
So if people want to reach out to you for learning about what you're doing with coaching, follow you on social media, what's the best place for people to reach out to you?
Usually Facebook. I've been going heavier on Facebook lately. I have a free Facebook group that people can join. It's called the Prime Wholesaling Method. I go live there at least once a week and just you know, to teach all the strategies and stuff like that. And I respond to, I mean, anywhere on social media that you find me, you can message me. I respond to all that. But pretty much on that free Facebook group, that's when, you know, where you'll get all the information.
Cool. Yeah. And I'll put a plug out there too, just cause I've been a part of that group. I've seen you coach other people. You'll get a ton of value out of being in even just the free group like that, of just learning about stuff that you thinking about things that you, in a way you wouldn't normally, as you've probably seen from this podcast. So, check them out, John. Thanks for coming on. I'm glad we finally got to do this. It's a lot of fun.
Me too. Thank you for having me, guys.
Awesome. Thanks, guys.